Student radio may contain coarse language and adult content. Listener discretion is advised.
We started out with nothing and look how far we've come.
Indeed.
Welcome to Left, Right and Centre.
What is this, the 13th week now?
Unlucky for some, the 13th week we are in. That didn't rhyme.
Yeah. I was going to say very lucky for us.
Yes, very lucky for us that we're still here.
I don't think luck, I think this is all talent.
I'm not sure if it has anything to do with luck. Mm. This is Left, Right and Centre, the show where we'd maybe rather be sleeping, but instead we're bringing you an hour's worth of entertainment.
It's very selfish, so that's,
in,
I think.
In many ways it's lucky for you as well. I am Casey. I'm joined by
Timothy over here.
And Matteo over here.
And finally, Rudolph. Hello, everyone.
Hello, I'm Rudolph. Rudolph. Yes. This week on the show, news, and more news.
We have a, we have a jam-packed show. Tim. Well,
jam-packed. We're going to talk about the North Koreans. They've been up to their tricks again.
That's nuclear war, folks. We're talking about nuclear war.
Up to their hijinks.
We're going to talk about voluntary euthanasia / assisted suicide.
That's death, Casey.
Death and destruction.
We're going to talk about... what else are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about hoaxes.
Yeah, we're going to talk about hoaxes
Recent hoaxes. But first, I think it has been pretty much a week since we've all seen each other, guys. Good weekends?
Very good weekends for me. How about you, Chris?
My weekend could have been better, Casey.
Really? What was wrong with you?
I'd like to point out my name is not Chris, it's Rudolph.
Oh, sorry, Rudolph.
Yeah,
sorry.
No, we apologise, Rudolph.
Look, I had a bit of a strange weekend. It was Saturday night, right, guys? I had a good Saturday. Until about 3 a.m. Where myself, Matteo and Casey, we were getting a bus. And so I was at the bus stop and this might seem a bit strange, it seems like I'm launching into some sort of gag, which I'm not, I promise. And there were two sort of seats at the bus stop. On one of them, Casey and Matteo were snuggling.
We weren't snuggling, it was very cold.
I was being snuggled.
So, okay, they were snuggling. And
I was not initiating any snuggling.
Neither was I.
I felt a bit left out, and there was a relatively attractive young woman sitting at the bus stop. And we got talking. It was good. We got on really well.
It was magical.
It was probably the funniest I've ever been since the Friday night. So it was Saturday. Friday I was probably more funny, but Saturday.
Mm. He was being very creative. I heard
very creative.
over the noise of the wind and the rain. I heard him say phrases like "waiting for Godot," "forgot what else he said."
But basically, Rudolph was being very very luminous.
Yep, mm, yep,
charming.
Yep. At the time, I was just sort of like, oh, this is a fun conversation. Oh, she was pretty nice. That was good fun. So we all got on the bus, and then she got off the bus, and then we got off the bus. And in all that time, I was like, I didn't really care about asking for a number because I thought, it was all right. But
just a fun conversation.
Yeah, just a fun conversation. Bit of fun. Nice to talk to people. And then I realised, actually, I regretted it. So,
why did you regret it?
Well, because actually, I really think I should have asked for a number.
I'm not going to lie. You probably should have asked for a number. It would have been a prime occasion to do exactly that.
There was definite chemistry there. That,
of the physical sort.
Well, of all sorts.
All sorts.
Of the chemical sort, perhaps.
Chemistry of the chemical sort, yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think the point is, I'm an idiot.
I think the point is also that we can't just spend the entire show laughing at our fellow Left, Right and Centre presenters.
Mm. Well, we can, and I will.
Well, we can.
Speaking of fellow Left, Right and Centre presenters, uh-huh. Matteo, uh-huh. you said uh-huh. that the Break It Down Gigamatic theme was your favourite theme.
It's the best theme on student radio.
That's just idiotic. Clearly, our theme is the best.
And if not ours, then maybe Illuminati's.
No.
No.
No?
It goes us, Gigamatic, then maybe Illuminati.
Gigamatic's not actually a segment theme, though.
No, look, anyway, yeah, what Chris's anecdote of profound, dissatisfaction and anguish, really, has shown us is that we can't be sort of lighthearted all the time. Sometimes it does get serious. We have to tone it down a little bit. There has been a story recently in the news about a student from the University of Dublin. His name's Shane Fitzgerald. He's 22 years old, studying sociology. What he's actually gone and done is he's actually just gone and posted a phony quote on the Wikipedia page. We all know Wikipedia is a user-edited encyclopedia on them internets.
Tim, would you like us to explain Wikipedia
No, I know what Wikipedia is because that's not a social networking site. See, Wikipedia is the one I use to explain networking sites.
But they do collaboratively work on their articles. So in many ways, it's a social encyclopedia.
If it doesn't have a ridiculous method of quantifying exactly your number of friends, then it's okay with me.
Kids, anyway. He fabricated an entire quote, and he attributed it to the recently deceased French composer, I believe his name was Maurice Jarre. Hmm. Maurice Jarre was his name. And the quote, it's actually
Was it believable?
It was actually a very impressive quote. I've got it here. I'll read it. It's, "One could say my life itself has been one long soundtrack. Music was my life, music brought me to life, and music is how I will be remembered long after I leave this life. When I die, there will be a final waltz playing in my head than only I can hear. Now, the thing is,
it sounds like the kind of thing a composer, a creative type would say.
It's a really good quote. Deathbed. But the amazing thing about this quote was entirely fabricated. It was removed by Wikipedia twice, and yet it showed up in virtually every single obituary that was published on relevant blogs and internet websites. The Guardian of the UK, quite a reputable newspaper, I'm sure you'd all agree, was the only one who actually contacted Fitzgerald personally to apologise and admit that they had been culpable. Yeah, they lifted it straight from Wikipedia.
Now this is amazing to me because you think journalists they come through universities, they do their Bachelor of Media Journalism. If you learn anything from university, it's don't use Wikipedia as a source. It's not reliable.
Casey, the problem with that is a lot of the current journalists, like the senior journalists who might be writing things at this point, Wikipedia probably didn't exist when they went through university, and therefore they wouldn't have learned it.
You don't think they have some kind of professional responsibility to keep their skills up to date?
I do, but actually, my point was a really silly one. The bigger issue here is actually, it's about time pressure. So basically, journalists in this environment, jobs are being cut. There's not as much time to research articles, and there's increased competition amongst media, and the result is they don't really have time to look at things properly. So they're forced to use press releases, just lift quotes from Wikipedia without having the chance to follow them up.
So it's the market's fault that journalists can't read footnotes?
Pretty much.
Or notice their complete absence.
Complete absence of the market. Well, but yeah.
What did the editors of some kind of newspapers say? Was their response about the story after they'd had egg splattered in their face?
Well, none of them were particularly happy. In fact, a lot of them personally contacted Fitzgerald to express their dismay, and I believe a few of them called him a vandal who had just copied and pasted and really ruined their stories. But of course,
so it's his fault now.
Well, apparently so.
I didn't do a good job, so I'm going to blame someone else.
I'm going to blame the kid whose trick I fell for.
Joe, don't call him a kid. He's 22. Which is older than you. I'm just saying.
Most people are older than me. I call them kid. Doesn't stop me.
Fair enough.
Try and stop me. I wonder, is this simply a question or trade-off with the quality and the speed of reporting in this era, Chris, as you touched upon, of incredibly high levels of competition amongst media and a quality of reporting, which I'm sure we'd probably all agree is still paramount.
Surely not. I mean, all it requires is a little case like this where, quite a reputable news source has just been humiliated by the fact that they've been fooled by somebody doing something that is not right. This guy shouldn't be vandalising Wikipedia, and it makes life hard for people like us who just want to, get to the bottom of stuff.
But, it's an irresponsible thing to do.
Tim, you could say that if it gets in the way of us, getting to the bottom of stuff, then it's our responsibility to make sure that everything's legitimate.
And even more so, the major media outlets. And it's not a difficult thing to say, if there is a fact or figure or quote in Wikipedia that doesn't have a footnote, don't bloody well use it.
Tim, I don't disagree. But, I mean, the trouble is, it's all a matter of time. Like, it all adds up. So, say in the case there's one story like this, that's fair enough. But there are four or five or six. People just don't have the time to search through them all.
Then just don't use it if it's not footnoted. I mean, I don't think it's that. It's particularly difficult.
But if you're as a journalist given a deadline to say write up this obituary and have it ready in an hour or two, and you know that if you don't have it up by that time, your major competitors will. Your major rivals in the media will. Sometimes you succumb to the temptation.
Well, I can only hope that the humiliation that's brought on by something like this will outweigh that consideration.
Some sort of guideline in editorial policy will be revised.
I agree with that.
Let's go on to the sensitive topic of euthanasia.
Euthanasia, yeah. It's come up. There's been a couple of news stories. The Tasmanian Greens have tabled a bill in the lower house in the Tasmanian Parliament, which is, I think it's called the Dying with Dignity Bill 2009. That's trying to kick off the debate. They're reasonably confident we'll get through the lower house. The upper house will probably be a bit more of a challenge for them. Also, in Washington State, in the United States, the first person has availed themselves of their new laws.
Also so, called the Death with Dignity.
I believe that's what they're called. We thought, this gives us a bit of a segue into an interesting and controversial topic.
Yeah, people have stopped kind of just talking about it as a hypothetical, maybe, and people are trying to start tabling bills.
Especially in the sort of the Western countries that often aren't associated with this sort of a slightly more liberal approach to issues like this. Australia and the United States. I thought we'd open that up to discussion. So what do you think, guys? Any strong opinions?
Well, okay, so there are kind of, there are three main ways you can commit euthanasia, for want of a better way of putting it.
Mm.
There's the passive euthanasia, which is withholding treatments, knowing it will cause death, or giving medication. Non-active, withdrawing life support. And active, yeah, in which you're using actual lethal substances or force. And I guess each of them have different ethical implications, mm. because to the person that has to do it, it would be very much a different state of mind.
Well, not only in that respect, but in terms of there are philosophical and moral implications that, you know, obviously depend on how you see, in what context you talk about human life and the way that should be dealt with.
Well, I think from a utilitarian point of view, there's no grounds on which euthanasia shouldn't be, I mean, on any grounds it should be permitted, because, I mean, apart from anything else, if someone doesn't want treatment, those resources are going to someone who wants to die and they could be better spent given to someone else.
Okay. Well, that's one of these perspectives, and I think a lot of this is the sort of the consequentialist utilitarian perspective on this issue has got quite a bit of favour. It's you know, one that's got some very famous defenders. Peter Singer, a man for whom I have quite a bit of respect philosophically, is one. But I think it does oftentimes, it answers one question but not the others. A significant problem that lots of people have with euthanasia are practical difficulties and slippery slope arguments, which aren't always philosophically rigorous, as it were, but they are, I think, a question that needs to be addressed.
That's fair enough. So we're talking here about, particularly about the issue of informed consent and whether and how it can be determined. And also circumstances, like in terms of... And there are some circumstances where, like, say, a patient is unable to make the decision for themselves,
mm-hmm.
Someone else will decide on their behalf,
yep.
So a caregiver or... And that, for me, is the biggest problem. Like, I'm in favour of most euthanasia because I think if someone's able to make the choice and they decide they don't want to go on living, we shouldn't force them to. But in a circumstance where they're not able to actually decide, even if, like, they had privately said to someone else, it's a bit... It seems a bit tricky to me for anyone to know conclusively that that's what they actually wish.
Mm. I think, for me also, I'm incredibly uneasy in this debate, and I think one of those things that needs to be... People talk about informed consent, but I think there is another element to the discussion which is sort of some level of psychological duress, which is something that's referred to where, you know, some people's attitude... when it comes to euthanasia, and you know whether or not they want to, they, giving the option and providing a societal acceptance of allowing people to end their lives if they don't want to continue them. You don't think that there is an additional avenue for abuse there, not only intentionally but also unintentionally, where people can sort of feel like, well, I'm a burden to my family, or where genuine, you know, psychological issues such as depression can start to play a big role there.
You're trying to say people might think it's an easier way out than just suicide.
I think he's trying to say it will lead people to see suicide as a more acceptable social practice. Is that what you're saying, Dan?
Not just as an acceptable social practice, but as to provide some sort of what's the word? Some sort of impetus on individuals to say, well, you know, I should perhaps not be burdening others in this way.
Tim, I think you have to be careful about making sure you don't give that impression, but I don't think that in itself is a reason, you know, not to allow euthanasia, because obviously if you have programs that say, you know, like, that deal with depression, it's an ongoing problem anyway. There are people who feel like, you know, I'm a burden on my family and I should probably end my life. And I think that's a separate problem. I don't know that saying euthanasia, as in, like, if someone's going to die, say, in a month and they're in immense pain, I don't see how accepting that necessarily leads to the other thing. I think they're separate issues and should be addressed separately.
I suppose, but I do get cautious when people use this justification that if somebody, you know, wants to go on living, why should we remove them of the capacity? Somebody doesn't want to go on living, why should we remove them of the capacity to make that decision? And I think in that respect, it is vulnerable to the criticism that I just mentioned.
Where most of my arguments and contentions on this issue stem from is my belief that the initial premise is that one person is the sole possessor of his or her life and thus should have the final say on its outcome. And of course, there are situations where they aren't capable of making that decision by themselves. Where you draw the line there, precisely how unwell they have to be, or precisely how long they have to live. But I honestly think that to try and justify really on any grounds, really the removal of this Well, I'm not even sure.
I'd say a fundamental right, Mateo.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if it's a right. It's just inherent.
Yeah.
The most fundamental thing you own is your life. And for that reason, I think it's your say what you do with your life. I think if you feel you're being a burden on your family, and if this is something that has been discussed amongst family and a consensus has been reached, then I think, personally, that's certainly sufficient reason to carry out. This is an issue I feel quite strongly about. It's informed by parents and what they've told me about what they want to happen or what they want me to do if such a thing happens to them. If they, for example, have a terminal disease, they don't want me to prolong what they don't consider to really be a life anymore. A life only in the most basic of senses, but in the sense of functioning on some profound human level. You know, they can't do that anymore. They are, you know, they're, I don't know, if you want to be really crude about it, they're incontinent, say. They're just incapable of functioning, really, on any level that's more than extremely basic.
And I think what you've highlighted quite strongly, Mateo, is that this is an issue of real feeling. And when we're talking about, you know, about a right, it seems to me that when someone, you know, like, feels so strongly that they don't, you know, they don't want to be in the situation where they don't have control over their own body, for instance, it seems an act of incredible cruelty to take that choice away from them.
Yeah, but and you can talk about it in terms of rights of individuals, but the fact of the matter is that an issue like this that a society has to deal with has to be dealt with legislatively. And the complexities of this issue can't be lost in that. And where people can talk about, you know, my right to die and that having expressed consent within their families, it's simply not sufficient to be able to say to a doctor, you know, I've had many conversations with my parents and I know this is what they want. People shouldn't, you know, there are no... There is just no way that is a sufficient legal mechanism to be having this discussion. It shouldn't stop us trying to find a sufficient legal mechanism.
Tim,
absolutely, but that's a cause for discussion. And I think that the depth of the complexity here has to be, you know, with issues like this, the devil is very much in the detail and how you feel like, you know, and how you deal with it.
I agree with that, Tim. I think it's a very complex issue and there are no easy solutions. And I think probably we should go to something else, Casey.
We should go to this.
As anybody who regularly catches public transport will attest, there are some smells which are not meant to be smelled and some areas which are not meant to be poked. The main problem is that people on public transport don't go out of their way to make your life a living hell. Now, ordinarily, this is no bad thing. In most situations, such as while driving, cooking, or sleeping, people not going out of their way to make your life a living hell is very much a pleasant experience. But when on board the so-called quarter-hourly journey machine, it is almost always coupled with another quality which negates its positive connotations. A quality which seems to be on the rise in the modern world. Ignorance. It is this quality which enables fellow commuters to befoul one's person with assaults on all the senses, and horrifyingly, it's also this quality which allows them to remain blissfully unaware that they're doing it. Take this story, for example. I was on my bus this morning, and when I boarded the vessel, I took the seat which was least intrusive, by convention, which in this case happened to be the window seat on the very back row. My journey was pleasant until two older fellows entered the establishment, electing to sit themselves on the back row also. It was at this point that they made two mistakes. Firstly, they chose to sit immediately to my left, despite the fact that I'd purposefully left as much space on the row as possible, and secondly, they began arguing. Now, the situation as I've described it so far is unbearable enough, but it was worsened to no end by the fact that when the argument became heated, the gentleman closest to me placed his right hand on his hip, as if he were a crude form of teapot. My problem with this is twofold. Obviously, every time we rounded a corner, his outstretched limb dug me hard in the ribs, an irritant which was made somewhat more unpleasant by the fact that his gesture was clearly doing very little to support his argument. But more importantly, considering the pressure of the contact between us, he couldn't possibly have been unaware of the pain he was causing me. Nor could he have been unaware that a movement of a negligible amount of distance to the left would have alleviated my discomfort. And yet, even as, like any red-blooded Englishman, I ignored his onslaughts of deliberate ignorance to my plight, He himself ignored the fact that my ribs were undergoing cumulative erosion. My point is simply that unpleasant situations such as this on public transport are commonplace, and rather unfortunately, they are ruddy irritating. For no good reason, common and self-suggesting social rules such as don't stick your arm in someone or don't stare directly at someone for 20 minutes don't seem to have any value within the world of the commuter who chooses public transport, and this is a shame. Some common decency would not go amiss. And now, strippers.
Are you ready for this, guys?
Absolutely.
You know what? Every week I get surprised.
Every week you break the rules. If I play this sound, you're supposed to not talk. Starting now.
Not during the sound.
Casey, can I suggest a lifetime ban on Mateo in Rapid Fire News?
I'm considering it. I am the Rapid Fire News master. Wait for me to read the story and then you can talk. A large number of goats on a Taiwanese island may have died of exhaustion caused by the noise of a nearby wind farm. Before the 8 turbines were installed near his land, farmer Kuo Jin Chan had about 700 goats, but he told the BBC that he has now just over 250 left. The Council of Agriculture says it suspects that noise may have caused the goats' demise through lack of sleep. Mr. Kuo, speaking to the BBC, said, "The goats looked skinny, and they weren't eating. One night, I went out to the farmhouse, and the goats were all standing up. They weren't sleeping. I didn't know why. If I had known, I would have done something to stop the dying." A local livestock inspector from the Agriculture Council said that Mr. Kuo was the only farmer to have reported such large cattle deaths. "Guys, surely this means that proponents of alternative and renewable energies are morally bankrupt. How can we take any people responsible for mass goat murder seriously?"
I don't think we can.
Absolutely not.
No, I certainly
think
this is...
In fact, Tim certainly can't take it seriously.
I think that's hilarious.
I certainly think this has undermined all...
Tim, you've often said before that deaths are a serious issue. This is like mass slaughter, mass killings. This is, you know, like worse than most murders, and I think you should actually be ashamed of yourself.
Well, I'm sorry.
Well, how many goats are equivalent to one human?
One to one.
So this is...
And, Mateo, you're an animal lover. Surely you believe that too.
Yeah, no. I asked you for what you thought it was. I thought it's basically two humans to every one goat.
Oh, okay.
So this is like
350 deaths.
What about 3 to 7?
Oh no, 1,500. What?
3 to 7 goats to people.
7 out of every 10.
I think you're thinking goat years, not human years to goat years.
I do have a database of animal years to human years in my head. I do have things mixed up.
An office worker in San Jose, California, cleaning a fridge full of rotten food, inadvertently created a smell so noxious it sent 7 co-workers to hospital and made many others ill. Firefighters had to evacuate the AT&T building after the fumes prompted a call to 911. A hazmat team was also called in. They found the refrigerator unplugged and crammed with moldy food. Authorities said the actions of the worker who moved the food into a nearby room and cleaned the fridge with chemicals caused 28 people to be treated for vomiting and nausea. The worker who cleaned out the fridge did not require treatment, though, as allergies mean she does not have a sense of smell. Kudos, I say, to a person whose actions, while noble, had more or less the opposite outcome as planned. How can a fridge be so disgusting?
I think this is a whole new sphere of bioterrorism. Just unplug the fridges left, right and centre.
Well, actually, you know, I don't... Oh, I see what you did there, Tim.
Thanks for the plug.
Thanks for the plug. It's a good show. Can I just say, I actually don't think this is all that strange. Like, whoever picked it out for Rapid Fire News obviously hasn't worked in a chicken fridge before, because when I worked at Foodland, several of my colleagues died, probably about 15 over the course of my 3 months there. And frankly...
Does that say something about your sense of smell or immune system? That you didn't die?
Pretty much. Well, it's like I've always hated chicken, so I've always hated how it smells and tastes, and as a result, I've built up a resistance. That doesn't really make much sense.
It's really miserable to be around, maybe. I mean, if over a dozen of your work colleagues, whilst you were there, died.
Some have also suggested that I killed them, but I reject that.
Anthony Steen, the long-standing Conservative MP for Totnes in England's southwest, has announced he will not contest the next election. It was alleged by the Daily Telegraph that he claimed more than £87,000 over a space of 4 years for his country home, including paying a forestry expert to inspect trees. However, he told the BBC's World at One programme,
"I think I behaved, if I may say so, impeccably. I've done nothing criminal. That's the most awful thing. And do you know what it's about? Jealousy. I've got a very, very large house. Some set people say it looks like Balmoral. It's the photographs. The way they photograph looks like Balmoral."
Mr. Steen later issued an apology for his comments, saying he was deeply upset at the time. Guys, is this the most childish MP ever?
Most children can pronounce the letter M.
he was very, very upset.
Guys, can I just say, I am actually... I mean, honestly, you're making fun of someone's speech impediment. That's pretty low. I think you were the most childish radio presenters ever.
it's a bit harsh. I can see maybe how you empathise with him, because maybe he felt some inadequacy about the size of his own house. There was another Conservative MP who had a larger house still.
They were all jealous of him, though, Mateo. They were all jealous of him.
Not all his detractors were, but probably that stemmed from his own feelings of inadequacy.
It's taken well over half his life, but Graham Parker has finally, after 26 long years, completed his Rubik's Cube. The 45-year-old builder from Porchester, Hampshire, admitted, "I cannot tell you what a relief it was to finally solve it. It has driven me mad over the years. It felt like it had taken over my life. I've missed important events to stay in and solve it, and I would lie awake at night thinking about it. When I clicked that last bit into place and each face was a solid colour, I wept." Parker's wife, Jean, said that it felt as though there had been three people in their marriage. "When I met Graham, he was already obsessed with the cube, spending hours on it every day. I've often thought about getting rid of it, but I knew he would not rest until he had solved it." A spokesman for the governing body, the World Cube Association, said it was definitely the longest it has taken to finish a Rubik's Cube. Guys, most determined builder ever, and why is there a Rubik's Cube Association?
I don't know.
It seems to me like some unwitting soul from the World Cube Association just had a microphone shoved under their nose and were asked to give a couple of words about this very interesting story. And he just said, "Oh, yeah, look, we don't know the facts, but that's definitely the longest anyone has ever been determined to finish the cube for."
I don't believe they really take statistics on that.
I always throw it away after 10 minutes.
And I also think actually the wife is the problem here, because she was saying she felt like there were three people in the marriage. And so, obviously a Rubik's Cube isn't a person.
And obviously she's the third wheel, because when they met, he was already enraptured by the cube.
So,
enraptured.
That's a good word.
Well, so do you reckon he just spent 26 years just randomly swooping him?
Yeah, well, you'd have to have worked through all the combinations by then.
Mm. Oh, I'm not sure. And eventually he realised he was onto a good thing. And then he started crying.
Hmm. A 3-year-old from Wellington bought an earth-moving digger over the internet, the Times of India reports. Pippi Quinlan made the winning $20,000 New Zealand dollar bid on the Kobelco digger with a few mouse clicks at the auction site Trade Me while her parents slept. Pippi's mother, Sarah Quinlan, said, "The first I knew about it was when I came down and opened up the computer. I saw an email from Trade Me saying I had won an auction, and another email from the seller saying something like, 'I think you'll love this digger.' It wasn't until I went back and reread the emails that I saw $20,000 and got the shock of my life." She immediately called the seller and auction site to explain what had happened. The seller was reimbursed and the item relisted. Guys, is this enough to say that we should impose some small test before a person is able to buy anything online? Like, for example, some sort of basic math problem?
Can I say I worked this question deliberately to say that that's not the best idea, because it may preclude Tim from purchasing anything online.
Sorry?
Your skills of arithmetic are very poor, Tim.
You've got to hang on. He wouldn't even be able to get to the site Trade Me.
Are there shops on the interweb?
Yeah. No, it's like a virtual marketplace. You like markets, right, Tim?
But how do they use money?
Well, you see, the money isn't, like, physically handed over, as in a typical marketplace. It's, in fact, sent through the tubes.
Well, I mean, Tim, you shouldn't be new to this idea. Like, say you want to transfer some money from your bank account to your friend's bank account. You'd go to the teller and you say, "Can you put $4,000 in my friend's bank account?" And then you sign, and then they're like, "Yes," and then they do it.
Yeah. That's
transferred virtually, Tim, basically, or, you know, electronically.
I keep my money under my bed.
It's really very, very simple.
Tim, what's your address?
It's not that dumb. Police are desperately looking for a New Zealand couple who disappeared after a bank mistakenly deposited $6.1 million into their account, the Times of India reports. The couple, who run a petrol station in the city of Rotorua, applied to Westpac for a $6,000 overdraft, but instead got a pleasant surprise when 1,000 times that was paid into their account. New Zealand authorities said they had sought help from Interpol in locating the couple who disappeared on May 7, suggesting they believe the couple may have fled abroad with their cash. Massey University banking lecturer Claire Matthews said the lucky recipients likely would not get away with the cash. They've effectively, I guess, become thieves. But it's only going to be a matter of time before they are found, she told News Talk ZB Radio. The pair would be hard-pressed to argue they honestly believe they're entitled to such a huge sum of money, she added. Maybe they couldn't argue they're entitled to the money, but could they perhaps say they were leaving the country anyway, and they couldn't repay their money or they'd miss the flight?
I think that would be very suspicious when you just withdraw, I think it was nearly $4 million of the money that they were given, and just fly off to Hong Kong.
Can I just say, Tim, this is actually a compelling argument to be made for keeping all the money physically and under one's bed, because I imagine if the bank had delivered if $10 million was loaded up into their big delivery truck and then delivered to the front of the house, they'd notice. They'd be like, "Hey, this isn't 10 grand, this is..."
Yeah,
they'd have to get a very, very big bed.
Yeah.
A Taiwanese man has become a sitting target for a snake which bit his penis as he sat on his toilet. Grow up, guys. The China Times and Times of India reported, as soon as he sat down, he suddenly felt a knife-like pain and reacted instinctively by standing up. When he looked down, he saw the big snake. The 51-year-old from Nantou County was under medical care with minor injuries, a director at Puli Christian Hospital said. The director, who declined to be named, said, as soon as he's passed the risk of infection, he can go. Local television images showed the black and yellow reptile, reportedly a species of rat snake, being uncoiled and plucked slowly from the toilet bowl. Guys, I don't think we need to worry about a like funny line for this story. When he looked down, he saw the big snake. Come on.
I only started laughing because Tim started laughing.
It's like snakes on a plane. That this exact thing happened on Snakes on a Plane. I thought that is the most ridiculous. Like that was one of the most ridiculous things to happen in that film. Like every single part of a human being's body was bitten by a snake in that movie. I didn't think it would ever happen in real life. Yeah. Turns out,
Tim, can I just say that I don't think it's appropriate to be talking about, you know, a humorous or questionably humorous film in a serious news story.
And yeah, well, I mean, what I like is that it was basically a real-life equivalent of Snakes on a Plane and Lethal Weapon 2, where Danny Glover's character, there was actually a bomb on his toilet, and he had to get the bomb squad in, because he couldn't stand up or the whole thing would blow. It was a wonderful synthesis of the two come to fruition in real life.
Well, I think Tim's finally put himself together, so should we move on?
He was nearly suffocating there for a minute.
Yeah. But, A man who tried to hire a prostitute to remove his 14-year-old son's virginity as a present has been spared prison time by a London court, Reuters reports. The Polish national took the boy out in his car and allowed him to pick out the prostitute who was standing at the side of the road in the red-light district of Nottingham. But the 42-year-old father was arrested because the teenager had chosen an undercover police officer, Nottingham Crown Court heard. Prosecutor Adrian Harris said the man and his son had approached the undercover officer, whose codename was Sarah, and beckoned her over. However, when the car pulled over, the man was arrested by plainclothes police officers. Harris said that the boy said that they had driven past the girl and his dad pointed to her and said, "Will she do?" He said yes, and they had turned around. He said his dad did this because he was still a virgin and he was taking care of that for him. The court was told the boy would continue to live with his father. Guys, have you ever received any similarly inappropriate gifts from loved ones?
I can honestly say I have not.
Well, because the thing is, look, a lot of times when these stories come up, because a lot of them are about the Polish, I feel inclined to defend them. I don't know, maybe on the basis of heritage, or maybe I just don't think what they've done is that stupid. But this is like a really dumb shit thing to do. This is just so illegal what he did.
And honestly, he was 14.
There's no way I can, on any grounds, justify these actions.
There are three or four levels on which this is very, very wrong.
So wrong.
Some of which are very trivial and some of which are very, very serious.
And that's all the time we've got for that segment for this week.
Right, well, we promised at the beginning of the show we'd talk about the
nuclear war.
We promised it to you, and we're going to deliver it. North Korea has come into a bit of...
Hold on, Tim, I just want to clarify. We're not going to deliver nuclear war. Just don't want to alarm you, so people don't get concerned.
Well, unless you really want us to ring 8303-5000.
And we will press the button.
The radio equivalent of nuclear war, which is very explosive and with lots of fallout, potentially. Anyway, I don't want to stop you,
Tim. Am I able to continue now? Or
yes.
I mean, for those of you out there unfamiliar with metaphor, I wasn't actually being serious when I said we'd bring you nuclear war. Thank you for Chris for clarifying that. Anyway, North Korea has tested a nuclear device, which is the second time they've done that. I think the last time they did, the other time was 2006. And also since then they have tested three short-range surface-to-air missiles and have, you know, pretty much earned the almost universal condemnation of the international community in doing this. So we thought, we've had, you know, one talk about North Korea before, why not have another one?
You say almost universal condemnation. Was there someone that didn't condemn it?
The only country, as far as I can tell, the only country in the world who did not condemn the nuclear tests was Iran, who, of course, it would be more than a little bit hypocritical for them to condemn nuclear weapons program in North Korea.
So Liechtenstein, they condemned it.
I did briefly glance over Liechtenstein's response.
How
about Zimbabwe? Because we had that story last week about how
Zimbabwe haven't put out a response yet, but I imagine that would be condemning it also. Has anybody got any great issue? I suppose the interest here is more about there's two issues. Firstly, how do we deal with them? And secondly, what are the geopolitical implications for that region, which is very unstable? We'll hand to our expert on that matter, Chris.
Well, look, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, the fact that if the nuclear test was a success, and there's some talk that it was, but we can't confirm, there's been some talk that assuming it was a success, that means it'll be hard for the US or, you know, Japan, South Korea, whatever, to take action against North Korea if that were to emerge as a possibility. But the trouble for me is I'd actually like to say that I don't think they're likely to take action anyway, because the conventional, like the size of North Korea's conventional military is immense. They've got you know, one of the largest conventional militaries in the world, and the damage they could do to South Korean cities is immense, you know, is massive to begin with. They could, you know, they could basically, well, almost ruin the some of the industrial centres of South Korea. And I don't think that's a risk that any of the established powers would want to take. So, I mean, while I think nuclear power is a very, you know, like it's a good symbolic thing, I'm not sure that all the fuss about what it'll mean in practice is as much as it's talked up to be.
I wonder if possession of nuclear weapons, especially for an autarkic state like North Korea, is perhaps dual-fold, because it's very propagandistic and, like I said, very symbolic. It's a display of nationalism. They're sort of seen to be doing the right thing, and it's a national pride thing, or North Korea is industrialized enough to and built up enough to have a nuclear weapon. And also, it in some way, perhaps, you know, to external observers, like, legitimizes the current practices in this country. And also says, well, if you don't like what we're doing, if you don't like how we're running our country or how the country is being run, are you willing to step in and intervene now that we have nuclear weapons?
Yeah, I think also, I'm not sure. I partly agree with you, Chris, in that I don't see them having nuclear weapons is a huge sort of military power shift in the region. I do think the additional capacity, if they were to be able to weaponize these on a missile, would alter that in some respect. But I think what's more at issue here is that why have the North Koreans taken this path? And I think there's two, you know, I've been doing a little bit of reading, and there's two interesting schools of thought here. Firstly, it does give them something to force the other party members of the six-party talks, especially the United States. It does give them something to force them back to the table. And I realise it's a little bit flippant, but I think that every time they test a weapon, it's essentially a license to print money for North Korea, because, you know, they test a weapon. The international community is then, you know, expected to negotiate and give some concessions.
Is that necessarily the case, though? Is that the right attitude for the international community to be going into it with?
I don't think they have many other options.
No, no, you're right, Tim. There's not much of a choice in that respect, Casey. And certainly, I mean, because if the other parties want North Korea to de-weaponize, then obviously they've got a bargain with them.
Yeah, well, because certainly it makes other countries now more cautious in the way they deal with North Korea, because they feel the current situation is worthy of some sort of military intervention. They feel the current situation is so dire that there has to be an invasion of North Korea. Were they going to stop and think that they're going to be deterred by North Korea's possession of nuclear weapons? They're going to think, well, hang on, we are going to take heavy losses if we intervene in such a way, whether it's our standing army or our cities.
And yeah, that's true. I think also something which we haven't touched on yet, but we maybe should, is the domestic motive or potential domestic motivation behind it. And the thing about that is, Tim, as I understand it, that there are some succession issues with Kim Jong-il.
Kim Jong-il, well, obviously, I mean, he hasn't been in the best of health recently. He had it's widely reported he had a stroke mid-last year. And another element of this has surely got to be domestic. He hasn't been in the public sphere. I mean, they've only recently been the first images of him since he's had his stroke. And a lot of people are saying, well, this can sort of be a power issue and something to increase the nationalism of the country, so as to give him an option to perhaps introduce one of his, I think, three sons. I would be surprised if that's all he had, but the three favoured sons, no doubt, one of the three, and introduce one of them as the successor. And I've read an interesting comment on Reuters claiming that the majority of the North Korean public are actually unaware that he has any children.
But nuclear weapons help that how?
Well, in order, you know, in sort of saying, well, I'm standing up to the big, mean, you know, United States, and this is a powerful country, and, you know, this is, rather than coming to you from a position of weakness saying, I'm old, here's my successor, coming to the people and introducing a successor from a position of power, I think, would be something that would be good for him and good for his dynasty.
And it also demonstrates to the people that they've, you know, like the symbolic appeal of nuclear power is not insignificant. It says, you know, this is something great that our country's achieved. It also, Casey, also reinforces, you know, like it's a show of solidarity with the military to say that we're investing in military technology. And the military is a very powerful organisation in North Korea and is necessary if he wants to pass power on to his son, necessary to get their support.
I would have thought the Italian restaurant would have been enough, really.
And also, it just says that, here, I'm a strong leader. I've delivered you these weapons. Here is my son. I've determined him capable of carrying on my legacy.
Well, we're running out of time in the show, so we're going to have to leave it there. But
that's
That's where we're going to leave it anyway.
Perhaps one we'll touch upon again.
Maybe.
Student Radio at O-Week on Radio Adelaide 101.5 FM, as studious as you are.
We have to go. I was accused the last week because I was too monotonous in the outro. I'm going to be very pepped up. We're leaving you this week.
Casey, I'm still not sure there's much voice modulation there. No. Try and alter your
alter
pitch.
Alter my voice.
No, don't do that. That sounds terrible. Stop it.
Casey's now the second host to have sung on air.
That's not singing. No, I'm still the only one to have sung on air.
I would call that a warble.
Warble is a great word, Casey.
Instead, not as good as Enraptured. Instead, in the outro, I'll be the bland, monotonous one.
Normally, all right then.
Normally that role
Join
is filled
us
by
next
Casey.
Week on Left, Right and Centre. We'll be talking about more news. I'm Casey.
I've been Timothy.
Yeah, I've been Matteo. Listen next week. It might be interesting.
Yeah, I'm Rudolph, as always.